that you be ruthless in your negotiating, Monique. Make them pay you what they would pay a white man. And then once you've done that, every penny from it will be yours. Mine, I say, stunned. You should drink some water. You look ready to faint. Evelyn, an authorized biography about your life in which you talk about all seven of your marriages,
yes?
A book like that stands to make millions of dollars, even if I didn't negotiate. But you will, Evelyn says, taking a sip of her water and looking pleased. The question has to be asked. We've been dancing around it for far too long. Why on earth would you do that for me? Evelyn nods. She's been expecting this question. For now, think of it as a gift. But why? Next question. Seriously. Seriously, Monique. Next question. I accidentally drop my fork onto the ivory tablecloth. The oil from the dressing bleeds into the fabric, turning it darker and more translucent. The chopped salad is delicious, but heavy on the onions, and I can feel the heat of my breath permeating the space around me. What the hell is going on? I'm not trying to be ungrateful, but I think I deserve to know why one of the most famous actresses of all time would pluck me out of obscurity to be her biographer and hand me the opportunity to make millions of dollars off her story. The Huffington Post is reporting that I could sell my autobiography for as much as $12 million. Jesus Christ! Inquiring minds want to know, I guess. The way Evelyn is having so much fun with this, the way she seems to delight in shocking me, lets me know that this is, at least a little bit, a power play. She likes to be cavalier about things that would change other people's lives. Isn't that the very definition of power? Watching people kill themselves over something that means nothing to you? 12 million is a lot. Don't get me wrong, she says, and she doesn't need to finish the sentence in order for it to be completed in my head. But it's not very much to me. But still, Evelyn, why? Why me? Evelyn looks up at me, her face stoic. Next question. With all due respect, you're not being particularly fair. I'm offering you the chance to make a fortune and skyrocket to the top of your field. I don't have to be fair. Certainly not, if that's how you're going to define it, anyway. On the one hand, this feels like a no-brainer. But at the same time, Evelyn has given me absolutely nothing concrete. And I could lose my job by stealing a story like this for myself. That job is all I have right now. Can I have some time to think about this?
Think about what?
About all of this. Evelyn's eyes narrow ever so slightly.
What on earth is there to think about?
I'm sorry if it offends you, I say. Evelyn cuts me off. You haven't offended me. Just the very implication that I could get under her skin gets under her skin. There's a lot to consider, I say. I could get fired, she could back out, I could fail spectacularly at writing this book. Evelyn leans forward, trying to hear me out. For instance? For instance, how am I supposed to handle this with Vivant? They think they have an exclusive with you. They're making calls to photographers this very moment.
I told Thomas Welch not to promise a single thing. If they have gone out and made wild assumptions about some cover, that's on them.
But it's on me, too, because now I know you have no intention of moving forward with them.
So?
So what do I do? Go back to my office and tell my boss that you're not talking to Vivant, that instead you and I are selling a book? It's going to look like I went behind their backs on company time, mind you, and stole their story for myself.
That's not really my problem, Evelyn says. But that's why I have to think about it. Because it's my problem. Evelyn hears me. I can tell she's taking me seriously from the way she puts her water glass down and looks directly at me, leaning with her forearms on the table. You have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity here, Monique. You can see that, right? Of course. So do yourself a favor and learn how to grab life by the balls, dear. Don't be so tied up trying to do the right thing when the smart thing is so painfully clear. You don't think that I should be forthright with my employers about this? They'll think I conspired to screw them over. Evelyn shakes her head. When my team specifically requested you, your company shot back with someone at a higher level. They only agreed to send you out once I made it clear that it was you or it was no one. Do you know why they did that? Because they don't think I... Because they run a business, and so do you. And right now your business stands to go through the roof. You have a choice to make. Are we writing a book together or not? You should know. If you won't write it, I'm not going to give it to anyone else. It will die with me in that case. Why would you tell only me your life story? You don't even know me. That doesn't make sense. I'm under absolutely no obligation to make sense to you. What are you after, Evelyn? You ask too many questions. I'm here to interview you. Still. She takes a sip of water, swallows, and then looks me right in the eye. By the time we are through, you won't have any questions, she says. All of these things you're so desperate to know, I promise I'll answer them before we're done. But I'm not going to answer them 1 minute before I want to. I call the shots. That's how this is going to go. I listen to her and think about it and realize I would be an absolute moron to walk away from this, no matter what her terms are. I didn't stay in New York and let David go to San Francisco because I like the Statue of Liberty. I did it because I want to climb the ladder as high as I possibly can. I did it because I want my name, the name my father gave me in big, bold letters one day. This is my chance. Okay, I say. Okay, then. Glad to hear it. Evelyn's shoulders relax. She picks up her water again and she smiles. Monique, I think I like you, she says. I breathe deeply, only now realizing how shallow my breathing has been. Thank you, Evelyn. That means a lot. Evelyn and I are back in her foyer. I'll meet you in my office in a half hour. Okay, I say, as Evelyn heads down the corridor and out of sight. I take off my coat and put it in the closet. I should use this time to check in with Frankie. If I don't reach out to update her soon, she'll track me down. I just have to decide how I'm going to handle it. How do I make sure she doesn't try to wrestle this away from me? I think my only option is to pretend everything is going according to plan. My only plan is to lie. I breathe. One of my earliest memories from when I was a child was of my parents bringing me to Zuma Beach in Malibu. It was still springtime, I think. The water hadn't yet warmed enough for comfort. My mom stayed on the sand, setting down our blanket and umbrella, while my dad scooped me up and ran with me down to the shoreline. I remember feeling weightless in his arms. And then he put my feet in the water and I cried, telling him it was too cold. He agreed with me. It was cold. But then he said, "Just breathe in and out 5 times. And when you're done, I bet it won't feel so cold." I watched as he put his feet in. I watched him breathe, and then I put my feet back in and breathed with him. He was right, of course. It wasn't so cold. After that, my dad would breathe with me any time I was on the verge of tears. when I skinned my elbow, when my cousin called me an Oreo, when my mom said we couldn't get a puppy, my father would sit and breathe with me. It still hurts all these years later to think about those moments. But for now, I keep breathing right there in Evelyn's foyer, centering myself as he taught me. And then, when I feel calm, I pick up my phone and dial Frankie. Monique, she answers on the second ring. Tell me, how's it going? It's going well, I say. I'm surprised at how even and flat my voice is. Evelyn is pretty much everything you'd expect from an icon. Still gorgeous, charismatic as ever. And things are progressing. Is she committing to talk about any other topics than the gowns? What can I say now to start covering my ass? You know, she's pretty reticent about anything other than getting some press for the auction. I'm trying to play nice at the moment, get her to trust me a bit more before I start pushing. Will she sit for cover? It's too early to tell. Trust me, Frankie, I say. And I hate how sincere it sounds coming out of my mouth. I know how important this is, but right now, the best thing for me to do is to make sure Evelyn likes me so that I can try to garner some influence and advocate for what we want. Okay, Frankie says. Obviously, I want more than a few sound bites about dresses, but that's still more than any other magazine has gotten from her in decades. So, Frankie keeps talking, but I've stopped listening. I'm far too focused on the fact that Frankie's not even going to get sound bites. And I'm going to get far, far more. I should go, I say, excusing myself. She and I are talking again in a few minutes. I hang up the phone and breathe out. I've got this shit. As I make my way through the apartment, I can hear Grace in the kitchen. I open the swinging door and spot her cutting flower stems. Sorry to bother you. Evelyn said to meet her in her office, but I'm not sure where that is. Oh, Grace says, putting down the scissors and wiping her hands on a towel. I'll show you. I follow her up a set of stairs and into Evelyn's study area. The walls are a striking flat charcoal gray, the area rug a golden beige. The large windows are flanked by dark blue curtains, and on the opposite side of the room are built-in bookcases. A gray-blue couch sits facing an oversized glass desk. Grace smiles and leaves me to wait for Evelyn. I drop my bag on the sofa and check my phone. You take the disc, Evelyn says as she comes in. She hands me a glass of water. I can only assume the way this works is that I talk and you write. I suppose, I say, sitting in the desk chair. I've never attempted to write a biography before. After all, I'm not a biographer. Evelyn looks at me pointedly. She sits opposite me on the sofa. Let me explain something to you. When I was 14 years old, my mother had already died, and I was living with my father. The older I got, the more I realized that it was only a matter of time until my father tried to marry me off to a friend of his or his boss, someone who could help his situation. And if I'm being honest, the more I developed, the less secure I was in the fact that my father might not try to take something of me for himself. We were so broke that we were stealing the electricity from the apartment above us. There was one outlet in our place that was on their circuit, so we plugged anything we needed to use into that one socket. If I needed to do homework after dark, I plugged in a lamp in that outlet and sat underneath it with my book. My mother was a saint, I really mean it, stunningly beautiful, an incredible singer, with a heart of gold. For years before she died, she would always tell me that we were going to get out of Hell's Kitchen and go straight to Hollywood. She said she was going to be the most famous woman in the world and get us a mansion on the beach. I had this fantasy of the two of us together in a house, throwing parties, drinking champagne. And then she died, and it was like waking up from a dream. Suddenly I was in a world where none of that was ever going to happen, and I was going to be stuck in Hell's Kitchen forever. I was gorgeous, even at 14. Oh, I know the whole world prefers a woman who doesn't know her power, but I'm sick of all that. I turned heads. Now, I take no pride in this. I didn't make my own face. I didn't give myself this body. But I'm also not going to sit here and say, oh, shucks, people really thought I was pretty, like some kind of prig. My friend Beverly knew a guy in her building named Ernie Diaz, who was an electrician. And Ernie knew a guy over at MGM. At least, that was the rumor going around. And one day, Beverly told me she heard that Ernie was up for some job rigging lights in Hollywood. So that weekend, I made up a reason to go over to Beverly's, and I accidentally knocked on Ernie's door. I knew exactly where Beverly was, but I knocked on Ernie's door and said, "Have you seen Beverly Gustafson?" Ernie was 22. He wasn't handsome by any means, but he was fine to look at. He said he hadn't seen her, but I watched as he continued to stare at me. I watched as his eyes started at mine and grazed their way down, scanning every inch of me in my favorite green dress. And then Ernie said, "Sweetheart, are you 16? I was 14, remember? But do you know what I did? I said, "Why, I just turned." Evelyn looks at me with purpose. "Do you understand what I'm telling you? When you're given an opportunity to change your life, be ready to do whatever it takes to make it happen. The world doesn't give things. You take things. If you learn one thing from me, it should probably be that." "Wow. Okay," I say. "You've never been a biographer before, but you are one starting now." I nod my head. "I got it." "Good," Evelyn says, relaxing into the sofa. "So, where do you want to begin?" I grab my notebook and look at the scribbled words I've covered the last few pages with. There are dates and film titles, references to classic images of her, rumors with question marks after them. And then, in big letters that I went over and over with my pen, darkening each letter until I changed the texture of the page, I've written, "Who was the love of Evelyn's life?" That's the big question. That's the hook of this book. 7 husbands. Which one did she love the best? Which one was the real one? As both a journalist and a consumer, that's what I want to know. It won't be where the book begins, but maybe that is where she and I should begin. I want to know, going into these marriages, which is the one that matters the most? I look up at Evelyn to see her sitting up, ready for me. "Who was the love of your life? Was it Harry Cameron?" Evelyn thinks and then answers slowly, "Not in the way you mean, no." "In what way, then?" "Harry was my greatest friend. He invented me. He was the person who loved me the most unconditionally. The person I loved the most purely, I think. Other than my daughter. But no, he was not the love of my life."
"Why not?"
"Because that was someone else."
"Okay. Who was the love of your life, then?"
Evelyn nods, as if this is the question she's been expecting. As if the situation is unfolding exactly as she knew it would. But then she shakes her head again. "You know what?" she says, standing up. "It's getting late, isn't it?" I look at my watch. It's mid-afternoon.
"Is it?"
"I think it is," she says, and she walks toward me, toward the door. "All right," I say, standing up to meet her. Evelyn puts her arm around me and leads me out into the hallway. "Let's pick up again on Monday. Would that be okay?"
Sure. "Evelyn, did I say something to offend you?" Evelyn leads me down the stairs.
Not at all, she says, waving my fears aside. Not at all.
There is a tension that I can't quite put my finger on. Evelyn walks with me until we hit the foyer. She opens the closet. I reach in and grab my coat.
Back here? Evelyn says, Monday morning? What do you say we start around 10?
Okay, I say, putting my thick coat around my shoulders, if that's what you'd like. Evelyn nods. She looks past me for a moment over my shoulder, but appearing not to actually be looking at anything in particular. Then she opens her mouth.
I've spent a very long time learning how to spin the truth, she says. It's hard to undo that wiring. I've gotten too good at it, I think. Just now, I wasn't exactly sure how to tell the truth. I don't have very much practice in it. It feels antithetical to my own survival. But I'll get there.
I nod, unsure how to respond. So, Monday?
Monday,
Evelyn says with a long blink and a nod.
I'll be ready then.
I walk back to the subway in the chilly air. I cram myself into a car packed with people, holding on to the handrail above my head. I walk to my apartment and open my front door. I sit on my couch, open my laptop, and answer some emails. I start to order something for dinner, and it is only when I go to put my feet up that I remember there is no coffee table. For the first time since he left, I have not come into this apartment immediately thinking of David. Instead, what plays in the back of my mind all weekend, from my Friday night in to my Saturday night out and my Sunday morning at the park, isn't how did my marriage fail, but rather, who the hell was Evelyn Hugo in love with? I'm once again in Evelyn's study. The sun is shining directly into the windows, lighting Evelyn's face with so much warmth that it obscures her right side from view. We're really doing this, Evelyn and me. Subject and biographer. It begins now. She is wearing black leggings and a man's navy blue button-down shirt with a belt. I'm wearing my usual jeans, t-shirt, and blazer. I dressed with the intention of staying here all day and all night, if need be. If she keeps talking, I will be here listening. So, I say.
So,
Evelyn says, her voice daring me to go for it. Sitting at her desk while she is on the couch feels adversarial somehow. I want her to feel as if we are on the same team, because we are, aren't we? Although I get the impression you never know with Evelyn. Can she really tell the truth? Is she capable of it? I take a seat in the chair next to the sofa. I lean forward with my notepad in my lap and a pen in my hand. I take out my phone, open the voice memo app, and hit record. You sure you're ready? I ask her. Evelyn nods. Everyone I loved is dead now. There's no one left to protect, no one left to lie for but me. People have so closely followed the most intricate details of the fake story of my life. But it's not. I want them to know the real story, the real me. All right, I say. Show me the real you, then, and I'll make sure the world understands. Evelyn looks at me and briefly smiles. I can tell I've said what she wants to hear. Fortunately, I mean it. Let's go chronologically, I say. Tell me more about Ernie Diaz, your first husband, the one who got you out of Hell's Kitchen.
Okay, Evelyn says, nodding. It's as good a place to start as any.
Poor Ernie Diaz. My mother had been a chorus girl off-Broadway. She'd emigrated from Cuba with my father when she was 17. When I got older, I found out that chorus girl was also a euphemism for a prostitute. I don't know if she was or not. I'd like to think she wasn't, not because there's any shame in it, but because I know a little bit about what it is to give your body to someone when you don't want to. And I hope she didn't have to do that. I was 11 when she died of pneumonia. Obviously, I don't have a lot of memories of her, but I do remember that she smelled like cheap vanilla, and she made the most amazing caldo gallego. She never called me Evelyn, only Mija, which made me feel really special, like I was hers and she was mine. Above all else, my mother wanted to be a movie star. She really thought she could get us out of there and away from my father by getting into the movies. I wanted to be just like her. I've often wished that on her deathbed, she'd said something moving, something I could take with me always. But we didn't know how sick she was until it was over. The last thing she said to me was, "Dile a tu padre que estaré en la cama." Tell your father I'll be in bed. After she died, I would cry, only in the shower, where no one could see me or hear me, where I couldn't tell what were my tears and what was the water. I don't know why I did that. I just know that after a few months, I was able to take a shower without crying. And then, the summer after she died, I began to develop. My chest started growing, and it wouldn't stop. I had to rifle through my mom's old things when I was 12 years old, looking to see if there was a bra that would fit. The only one I found was too small, but I put it on anyway. By the time I was 13, I was 5'8", with dark, shiny brown hair, long legs, light bronze skin, and a chest that pulled at the buttons of my dresses. Grown men were watching me walk down the street, and some of the girls in my building didn't want to hang out with me anymore. It was a lonely business. Motherless, with an abusive father, no friends, and a sexuality in my body that my mind wasn't ready for. The cashier at the Five and Dime on the corner was this boy named Billy. He was the 16-year-old brother of the girl who sat next to me in school. One October day, I went down to the Five and Dime to buy a piece of candy, and he kissed me. I didn't want him to kiss me. I pushed him away, but he held onto my arm. "Oh, come on," he said. The store was empty. His arms were strong. He grasped me tighter, and in that moment, I knew he was going to get what he wanted from me, whether I let him or not. So I had two choices. I could do it for free, or I could do it for free candy. For the next 3 months, I took anything I wanted from that Five and Dime. And in exchange, I saw him every Saturday night and let him take my shirt off. I never felt I had much choice in the matter. Being wanted meant having to satisfy. At least that was my view of it back then. I remember him saying in the dark, cramped stockroom with my back against a wooden crate, "You have this power over me." He'd convinced himself that his wanting me was my fault. And I believed him. Look what I do to these poor boys, I thought. And yet also, here is my value, my power. So when he dumped me because he was bored with me, because he'd found someone else more exciting, I felt both a deep relief and a very real sense of failure. There was one other boy like that, whom I took my shirt off for because I thought I had to, before I started realizing that I could be the one doing the choosing. I didn't want anyone. That was the problem. To be perfectly blunt, I'd started to figure my body out quickly. I didn't need boys in order to feel good. And that realization gave me great power. So I wasn't interested in anyone sexually, but I did want something. I wanted to get far away from Hell's Kitchen. I wanted out of my apartment, away from my father's stale tequila breath and heavy hand. I wanted someone to take care of me. I wanted a nice house and money. I wanted to run far away from my life. I wanted to go where my mom had promised me we'd end up someday. Here's the thing about Hollywood. It's both a place and a feeling. If you run there, you can run towards Southern California, where the sun always shines and the grimy buildings and dirty sidewalks are replaced by palm trees and orange groves. But you also run toward the way life is portrayed in the movies. You run toward a world that is moral and just, where the good guys win and the bad guys lose, where the pain you face is only in an effort to make you stronger, so that you can win that much bigger in the end. It would take me years to figure out that life doesn't get easier simply because it gets more glamorous. But you couldn't have told me that when I was 14. So I put on my favorite green dress, the one I had just about grown out of, and I knocked on the door of the guy I heard was headed to Hollywood. I could tell just by the look on his face that Ernie Diaz was glad to see me. And that's what I traded my virginity for, a ride to Hollywood. Ernie and I got married on February 14th, 1953. I became Evelyn Diaz. I was just 15 by that point, but my father signed the papers. I have to think Ernie suspected I wasn't of age, but I lied right to his face about it, and that seemed good enough for him. He wasn't a bad-looking guy, but he also wasn't particularly book-smart or charming. He wasn't going to get many chances to marry a beautiful girl. I think he knew that. I think he knew enough to grab the chance when it swung his way. A few months later, Ernie and I got into his 49 Plymouth and drove west. We stayed with some friends of his as he started his job as a grip. Pretty soon we had saved enough to get our own apartment. We were on Detroit Street and Delongpre. I had some new clothes and enough money to make us a roast on the weekends. I was supposed to be finishing high school, but Ernie certainly wasn't going to be checking my report cards, and I knew school was a waste of time. I had come to Hollywood to do one thing, and I was going to do it. Instead of going to class, I would walk down to the Formosa Cafe for lunch every day and stayed through happy hour. I had recognized the place from the gossip rags. I knew famous people hung out there. It was right next to a movie studio. The red building with cursive writing and a black awning became my daily spot. I knew it was a lame move, but it was the only one I had. If I wanted to be an actress, I would have to be discovered. And I wasn't sure how you went about that except by hanging around the spots where movie people might be. So I went there every day and nursed a glass of Coke. I did it so often and for so long that eventually the bartender got sick of pretending he didn't know what gamble I was running. "Look," he said to me about 3 weeks in, "if you want to sit around here hoping Humphrey Bogart shows up, that's fine, but you need to make yourself useful. I'm not giving up a paying seat for you to sip a soda." He was older, maybe 50, but his hair was thick and dark. The lines on his forehead reminded me of my father's. "What do you want me to do?" I asked him. I was slightly worried that he'd want something from me that I had already given to Ernie. But he threw a waiter's pad at me and told me to try my hand at taking orders. I had no clue how to be a waitress, but I certainly wasn't going to tell him that. "All right," I said, "where should I start?" He pointed at the tables in the place, the booths, in a tight row. "That's table one. You can figure out the rest of the numbers by counting." "Okay," I said, "I got it." I stood up off the bar stool and started walking over to table two, where three men in suits were seated, talking, their menus closed. "Hey, kid," the bartender said. "Yes?" "You're a knockout. $5 says it happens for you." I took 10 orders, mixed up three people's sandwiches, and made $4. 4 months later, Harry Cameron, then a young producer at Sunset Studios, came in to meet with an exec from the lot next door. They each ordered a steak. When I brought the check, Harry looked up at me and said, "Jesus." 2 weeks later, I had a deal at Sunset Studios. I went home and told Ernie that I was shocked that anyone at Sunset Studios would be interested in little old me. I said that being an actress would just be a fun lark, a thing to do to pass the time until my real job of being a mother began. Grade A bullshit. I was almost 17 by that point, although Ernie still thought I was older. It was late 1954, and I would get up every morning and head to Sunset Studios. I didn't know how to act my way out of a paper bag, but I was learning. I was an extra in a couple of romantic comedies. I had one line in a war picture. "And why shouldn't he?" That was the line. I played a nurse taking care of a wounded soldier. The doctor in the scene playfully accused the soldier of flirting with me, and I said, "And why shouldn't he?" I said it like a child in a fifth-grade play, with a slight New York accent. Back then, so many of my words were accented. English spoken like a New Yorker, Spanish spoken like an American. When the movie came out, Ernie and I went to see it. Ernie thought it was funny, his little wife with a little line in a movie. I had never made much money before, and now I was making as much as Ernie after he was promoted to key grip. So I asked him if I could pay for acting classes. I'd made him arroz con pollo that night, and I specifically didn't take my apron off when I brought it up. I wanted him to see me as harmless and domestic. I thought I'd get further if I didn't threaten him. It grated on my nerves to have to ask him how I could spend my own money, but I didn't see another choice. "Sure," he said. "I think it's a smart thing to do. You'll get better, and who knows, you might even star in a picture one day." I would star. I wanted to punch his lights out. But I've since come to understand that it wasn't Ernie's fault. None of it was Ernie's fault. I'd told him I was someone else, and then I started getting angry that he couldn't see who I really was. 6 months later, I could deliver a line with sincerity. I wasn't great by any means, but I was good enough. I'd been in 3 more movies, all day player roles. I'd heard there was a part open to play Stu Cooper's teenage daughter in a romantic comedy, and I decided I wanted it. So I did something that not many other actresses at my level would have had the guts to do. I knocked on Harry Cameron's door. "Evelyn," he said, surprised to see me, "to what do I owe the pleasure?" "I want the Caroline part," I said, "in Love Is and All." Harry motioned for me to sit down. He was handsome for an executive. Most producers around the lot were rotund, a lot of them losing their hair. But Harry was tall and slim. He was young. I suspected he didn't even have a decade on me. He wore suits that fit him nicely and always complimented his ice-blue eyes. There was something vaguely Midwestern about him, not so much in how he looked but in the way he approached people, with kindness first, then strength. Harry was one of the only men on the lot who didn't stare directly at my chest. It actually bothered me, as if I'd been doing something wrong to not get his attention. It just goes to show that if you tell a woman her only skill is to be desirable, she will believe you. I was believing it before I was even 18. "I'm not going to bullshit you, Evelyn. Ari Sullivan is never going to approve you for that part." "Why not?" "You're not the right type." "What's that supposed to mean?" "No one would believe you were Stu Cooper's daughter." "I certainly could be." "You could not." "Why?"
"Why?"
"Yes, I want to know why."
"Your name is Evelyn Diaz."
"So?"
"I can't put you in a movie and try to pretend you're not Mexican."
"And Cuban?"
"For our purposes, same difference." It was not the same difference, but I saw absolutely no merit in trying to explain that to him.
"Okay," I said, "then how about the movie with Gary DuPont?"
"You can't play a romantic lead with Gary DuPont."
"Why not?"
Harry looked at me as if to ask if I was really going to make him say it.
"Because I'm Mexican?" I asked.
"Because the movie with Gary DuPont needs a nice blonde girl."
"I could be a nice blonde girl."
Harry looked at me. I tried harder.
"I want it, Harry.
And you know I can do it. I'm one of the most interesting girls you guys have right now. Harry laughed. You're bold. I'll give you that. Harry's secretary knocked on the door. I'm sorry to interrupt, but Mr. Cameron, you need to be in Burbank at 1:00. Harry looked at his watch. I made one last play. Think about it, Harry. I'm good, and I can be even better, but you're wasting me in these small roles. We know what we're doing, he said, standing up. I stood up with him. Where do you see my career a year from now, Harry? Playing a teacher with 3 lines? Harry walked past me and opened his door, ushering me out. We'll see, he said. Having lost the battle, I resolved to win the war. So the next time I saw Ari Sullivan at the studio dining hall, I dropped my purse in front of him and accidentally gave him an eyeful as I bent down to pick it up. He made eye contact with me, and then I walked away as if I wanted nothing from him, as if I had no idea who he was. A week later, I pretended I was lost in the executive offices, and I ran into him in the hallway. He was a portly guy, but it was a weight that suited him. He had eyes that were so dark brown it was hard to make out the irises, and the kind of 5 o'clock shadow that was permanent. But he had a pretty smile, and that was what I focused on. "Mrs. Diaz," he said. I was both surprised and not surprised to find that he had learned my name. "Mr. Sullivan," I said. "Please call me Ari." "Well, hello, Ari," I said, grazing my hand on his arm. I was 17. He was 48. That night, after his secretary left for the day, I was laid across his desk with my skirt around my hips and Ari's face between my legs. It turned out Ari had a fetish for orally pleasing underage girls. After about 7 minutes of it, I pretended to erupt in reckless pleasure. I couldn't tell you whether it was any good, but I was happy to be there because I knew it was going to get me what I wanted. If the definition of enjoying sex means that it is pleasurable, then I've had a lot of sex that I didn't enjoy. But if we're defining it as being happy to have made the trade, then, well, I haven't had much I hated. When I left, I saw the row of Oscars that Ari had sitting in his office. I told myself that one day I'd get one, too. Love Isn't All and the Gary DuPont movie I'd wanted came out within a week of each other. Love Isn't All tanked, and Penelope Quills, the woman who'd gotten the part I'd wanted opposite Gary, got terrible reviews. I cut out a review of Penelope and sent it by interoffice mail to Harry and Ari with a note that said, I would have knocked it out of the park. The next morning, I had a note from Harry in my trailer. Okay, you win. Harry called me into his office and told me that he had discussed it with Ari and they had 2 potential roles for me. I could play an Italian heiress as the 4th lead in a war romance, or I could play Joe in Little Women. I knew what it would mean, playing Joe. I knew Joe was a white woman, and still I wanted it. I hadn't gotten on my back just to take a baby step. Joe, I said, give me Joe. And in so doing, I set the star machine in motion. Harry introduced me to studio stylist Gwendolyn Peters. Gwen bleached my hair and cut it into a shoulder-length bob. She shaped my eyebrows. She plucked my widow's peak. I met with a nutritionist who made me lose 6 pounds exactly, mostly by taking up smoking and replacing some meals with cabbage soup. I met with an elocutionist who got rid of the New York in my English and who banished Spanish entirely. And then, of course, there was the 3-page questionnaire I had to fill out about my life until then. What did my father do for a living? What did I like to do in my spare time? Did I have any pets? When I turned in my honest answers, the researcher read it in one sitting and said, "Oh, no, no, no. This won't do at all. From now on, your mother died in an accident, leaving your father to raise you. He worked as a builder in Manhattan, and on weekends during the summer, he'd take you to Coney Island. If anyone asks, you love tennis and swimming, and you have a St. Bernard named Roger. I sat for at least 100 publicity photos, me with my new blonde hair, my trimmer figure, my whiter teeth. You wouldn't believe the things they made me model. Smiling at the beach, playing golf, running down the street being tugged by a St. Bernard that someone borrowed from a set decorator. There were photos of me salting a grapefruit, shooting a bow and arrow, getting on a fake airplane. Don't even get me started on the holiday photos. It would be a sweltering hot September day, and I'd be sitting there in a red velvet dress, next to a fully lit Christmas tree, pretending to open a box that contained a brand new baby kitten. The wardrobe people were consistent and militant about how I was dressed, per Harry Cameron's orders, and that look always included a tight sweater buttoned up just right. I wasn't blessed with an hourglass figure. My ass might as well have been a flat wall. You could hang a picture on it. It was my chest that kept men's interest. And women admired my face. To be honest, I'm not sure when I figured out the exact angle we were all going for, but it was sometime during those weeks of photo shoots that it hit me. I was being designed to be two opposing things, a complicated image that was hard to dissect but easy to grab onto. I was supposed to be both naive and erotic. It was as if I was too wholesome to understand the unwholesome thoughts you were having about me. It was bullshit, of course, but it was an easy act to put on. Sometimes I think the difference between an actress and a star is that the star feels comfortable being the very thing the world wants her to be. And I felt comfortable appearing both innocent and suggestive. When the pictures got developed, Harry Cameron pulled me into his office. I knew what he wanted to talk about. I knew there was one remaining piece that needed to be put into place. "What about Amelia Dawn? That has a nice ring to it, doesn't it?" he said. The two of us were sitting in his office, him at his desk, me in the chair. I thought about it. "How about something with the initials E.H.?" I asked. I wanted to get something as close to the name my mother gave me, Evelyn Herrera, as I could. "Ellen Hennessy?" He shook his head. "No, too stuffy." I looked at him and sold him the line I'd come up with the night before, as if I'd just thought of it. "What about Evelyn Hugo?" Harry smiled. "Sounds French," he said. "I like it." I stood up and shook his hand, my blonde hair, which I was still getting used to, framing my sight. I turned the knob to his door, but Harry stopped me. "There's one more thing," he said. "Okay?" "I read your answers to the interview questions." He looked at me directly. "Ari is very happy with the changes you've made. He thinks you have a lot of potential. The studio thinks it would be a good idea if you went on a few dates. If you were seen around town with some guys like Pete Greer and Brick Thomas, maybe even Don Adler." Don Adler was the hottest actor at Sunset. His parents, Mary and Roger Adler, were two of the biggest stars of the 1930s. He was Hollywood royalty. "Is that going to be a problem?" Harry asked. He wasn't going to mention Ernie directly because he knew he didn't have to. "Not a problem," I said. "Not at all." Harry nodded. He handed me a business card. "Call Benny Morris. He's a lawyer over in the bungalows. Handled Ruby Riley's annulment from Mac Riggs. He'll help you straighten it out." I went home and told Ernie I was leaving him. He cried for 6 hours straight, and then in the wee hours of the night, as I lay beside him in our bed, he said, "Bien, if that's what you want." The studio gave him a payout, and I left him a heartfelt letter telling him how much it hurt me to leave him. It wasn't true. but I felt I owed it to him to finish out the marriage as I'd started it, pretending to love him. I'm not proud of what I did to him. It didn't feel casual to me, the way I hurt him. It didn't then, and it doesn't now. But I also know how badly I'd needed to leave Hell's Kitchen. I know what it feels like to not want your father to look at you too closely, lest he decides he hates you and hits you, or decides he loves you a little too much. And I know what it feels like to see your future ahead of you, the husband who's really just a new version of your father, surrendering to him in bed when it's the last thing you want to do, making only biscuits and canned corn for dinner because you don't have money for meat. So how can I condemn the 14-year-old girl who did whatever she could to get herself out of town? And how can I judge the 18-year-old who got herself out of that marriage once it was safe to do so? Ernie ended up remarried to a woman named Betty, who gave him 8 children. I believe he died in the early 90s, a grandfather many times over. He used the payout from the studio to put a down payment on a house in Mar Vista, not far from the Fox lot. I never heard from him again. So if we are going by the metric that all's well that ends well, then I guess it's safe to say that I'm not sorry.
Evelyn, Grace says as she comes into the room, you have a dinner with Ronnie Buhlman in an hour. I just wanted to remind you.
Oh, right, Evelyn says. Thank you.
She turns to me once Grace has left.
How about we pick this up tomorrow, same time?
Yeah, that's fine, I say, starting to gather my things. My left leg has fallen asleep, and I tap it against the hardwood to try to wake it up.
How do you think it's going so far?
Evelyn asks as she gets up and walks me out.
You can make a story out of it.
I can do anything, I say.
Evelyn laughs and says, good girl. How are things?
My mom asks the moment I pick up the phone. She says, things, but I know she means, how is your life without David? Fine, I say as I set my bag on the couch and walk toward the refrigerator. My mother cautioned me early on that David might not be the best man for me. He and I had been dating a few months when I brought him home to Encino for Thanksgiving. She liked how polite he was, how he offered to set and clear the table. But in the morning before he woke up on our last day in town, my mom told me she questioned whether David and I had a meaningful connection. She said she didn't see it. I told her she didn't need to see it, that I felt it. But her question stuck in my head. Sometimes it was a whisper. Other times it echoed loudly. When I called her to tell her we'd gotten engaged a little more than a year later, I was hoping my mother could see how kind he was, how seamlessly he fit into my life. He made things feel effortless, and in those days that seemed so valuable, so rare. Still, I worried she would air her concerns again, that she would say I was making a mistake. She didn't. In fact, she was nothing but supportive. Now I'm wondering if that was more out of respect than approval. I've been thinking, my mom says as I open the refrigerator door. Or I should say, I've hatched a plan. I grab a bottle of Pellegrino, the plastic basket of cherry tomatoes, and the watery tub of burrata cheese. Oh, no, I say, what have you done? My mom laughs. She's always had such a great laugh. It's very carefree, very young. Mine is inconsistent. Sometimes it's loud. Sometimes it's wheezy. Other times I sound like an old man. David used to say he thought my old man laugh was the most genuine, because no one in their right mind would want to sound like that. Now I'm trying to remember the last time it happened. I haven't done anything yet, my mom says. It's still in the idea phase, but I'm thinking I want to come visit. I don't say anything for a moment, weighing the pros and cons, as I chew the massive chunk of cheese I just put into my mouth. Con?
She will critique every single outfit I wear in her presence. Pro? She will make macaroni and cheese and coconut cake. Con, she will ask me if I'm okay every 3 seconds. Pro, for at least a few days when I come home, this apartment will not be empty. I swallow. Okay, I say finally. Great idea. I can take you to a show, maybe. Oh, thank goodness, she says. I already booked the ticket. Mom, I say, groaning. What? I could have canceled if you'd said no, but you didn't. So great. I'll be there in about 2 weeks. That works, right? I knew this was going to happen as soon as my mom partially retired from teaching last year. She spent decades as the head of the science department at a private high school, and the moment she told me she was stepping down and only teaching 2 classes, I knew that extra time and attention would have to go somewhere. Yeah, that works, I say as I cut up the tomatoes and pour olive oil on them. I just want to make sure you're okay, my mom says. I want to be there. You shouldn't. I know, Mom, I say, cutting her off. I know. I get it. Thank you for coming. It will be fun. It won't be fun, necessarily, but it will be good. It's like going to a party when you've had a bad day. You don't want to go, but you know you should. You know that even if you don't enjoy it, it will do you good to get out of the house. Did you get the package I sent? She says. The package? With your dad's photos. Oh, no, I say. I didn't. We are quiet for a moment, and then my mom gets exasperated by my silence. For heaven's sake, I've been waiting for you to bring it up, but I can't wait any longer. How's it going with Evelyn Hugo? She says. I'm dying to know when you're not offering anything. I pour my Pellegrino and tell her that Evelyn is somehow both forthright and hard to read. And then I tell her that she isn't giving me the story for Vivant, that she wants me to write a book. I'm confused, my mom says. She wants you to write her biography? Yeah, I say. And as exciting as it is, there is something weird about it. I mean, I don't think she ever considered doing a piece with Vivant at all. I think she was... I trail off, because I haven't figured out exactly what it is I'm trying to say. What? I think about it more. Using Vivant to get to me. I don't quite know, but Evelyn is very calculating. She's up to something. Well, I'm not surprised. She wants you. You're talented. You're bright. I find myself rolling my eyes at my mother's predictability, but I do still appreciate it. No, I know, Mom. But there's another layer here. I'm convinced of it. That sounds ominous. I guess so. Should I be worried? My mom asks. I mean, are you worried? I hadn't thought about it in such direct terms, but I suppose my answer is no. I think I'm too intrigued to be worried, I say. Well, then, just make sure you share the real juicy stuff with your mother. I did suffer through a 22-hour labor for you. I deserve this. I laugh, and it comes out just a little bit like an old man. All right, I say. I promise. Okay, Evelyn says. Are we ready? She is back in her seat. I'm in my spot at the desk. Grace has brought us a tray with blueberry muffins, 2 white mugs, a carafe of coffee, and a stainless steel creamer. I stand up, pour my coffee, add my cream, walk back to the desk, press record, and then say, Yes, ready. Go for it. What happened next?
Goddamn Don Adler. Little Women turned out to be a carrot dangled in front of me, because as soon as I became Evelyn Hugo, young blonde, Sunset had all sorts of movies they wanted me to do, dumb, sentimental comedy stuff. I was okay with it for 2 reasons. One, I had no choice but to be all right with it because I didn't hold the cards, And two, my star was rising. Fast. The first movie they gave me to star in was Father and Daughter.